Thanks to the U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Just like notes in a song, sustainable living is just a series of small, eco-friendly choices that contribute to the melody. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on At Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Myrtle Beach is the beach. 60 miles of bright sand, water, and a wealth of wonderful music playing day and night. You can step into a simple beach bar and discover a surprising level of exciting musical talent. A place to kick back and groove to the enticing soundtrack of the most unexpected vacations around. With nothing but good vibes floating through the warm ocean air. Plan your own music-filled trip to America's Jukebox at visitmyrtlebeach.com.
I'm actor, writer, director, and sometimes DJ, Diallo Riddle.
And I'm producer, DJ, and songwriter, Luxury, also known as the guy who talks about interpolation.
And this is One Song,
the show where we deconstruct and celebrate some of your favorite songs from the past 60 years in music history and tell you why they deserve one more listen. You'll never hear these songs the same way again. So, Diallo, we're going to do something a little different today.
What?
Well, I think you're going to like it, but if you don't, we can always not do it.
Okay.
Okay, great. Usually on One Song, we do a deep dive into a single song. That is why the show is called One Song. It's a different song every episode.
That's true. But this time, we're going to each select three songs that change the way we listen to music. They're songs that hold a special place in our heart, not just because of how much we love them, but because of what they mean to us personally. I'm so excited to share my picks with our audience and with you.
Yeah, man, I am stoked to hear your songs and to share my songs with you as well. So I don't think we should wait any longer.
No.
I think the people are wondering, what are the songs?
Let's get into it.
They want to know what the songs are. Let's do it. Three songs on one song.
Many songs on one song.
Many songs on one song.
You know, before the show, the producers asked both of us which song we thought the other might choose. You know, one song I thought you choose.
Yeah. What'd you think?
You know what's funny is I think it maybe would be Blue Sky by ELO.
Mr. Blue Sky, please tell us why you had to pass.
Interesting. That's such an interesting choice. Why ELO is not super far off base with me, but I'm curious why that song in particular.
Because that is the ELO song that popped in my head just now.
Because it's in every movie ever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, Common sampled it for a decent song, I want to say, in the mid-2000s. But I'm, you know, I'm actually an ELO. I won't call myself a fan because I don't really know their music. But I feel like whenever I, like, look up that weird song that I've heard a couple of times in life and I'm like, who does this song? It'll often be Electric Light Orchestra. Like, you know, Xanadu is an example. They have some great songs on that soundtrack. But,
oh my God,
you know, such but clearly I'm Living way off. John. I'm way off.
It's not ELO, but you're making me reconsider some of my choices. I mean, ELO is in the pantheon of the greats for me. Jeff Lynne is one of my favorite all-time songwriter and producers.
Right.
I have a friend. I think we have a shared friend whose mom is dating him right now.
Oh, snap.
It's pretty cool that he's in our lives.
We've got the Jeff Lynne hot goss
vibe
for you.
Vibe.
He's dating.
I'm sorry to say that none of the three choices I did make today were ELO. Next time, though. Next time, for sure.
I was wrong. I didn't get it.
It's okay. We're still friends.
Guess one of mine.
Oh.
But with the caveat that it can't be one of the ones that is English-based.
Oh, man. I probably would guess, knowing how... Well, we have a lot of overlap. That's one of the fun things about our friendship. There's a lot of areas where you know a category or an era or something or an artist and I don't, and vice versa. One shared area, though, is I know that you're a, like, early 21st century New York underground indie music fan. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It might be in there.
Oh,
is it
that
Maps?
That would have been an excellent choice.
Maps?
Maps is not on there.
No. Okay.
No,
that's
but
your
ELO. So we're 0 for 2. Do we really know each other?
I don't know,
no, I
friends.
Mean that would have been a great choice. I will always if I'm driving through LA and I'm feeling reckless, I will always throw on Rich or Pin. Or Bang. Those are probably my three favorite. Yeah, yeah.
Songs. We were texting the other night, and like I was in the middle of watching Meet Me in the Bathroom, which is a documentary about this. Which you, I think, minutes later were like, "I'm watching it." Like, so we both revisited what is now 20 years ago, which is insane. My first pick is a song off one of my favorite records. It's the second album from a group of three MCs who formed a rap trio they described as jazz-informed hip-hop. The song is Black Ego, and the band is Diggable Planets.
Wow.
Okay.
In the east I rose, frozen the pose, over land is feast, flows that coolest summer breeze.
That song has
That's
everything.
That's the first song on the album, isn't it?
It's, I think there's like an intro and then it goes into that. But yeah, it opens up that record and Blowout Comb.
Slept On Classic. Slept On Classic album. And can I just say that one of the highlights, I have two really big highlights of the pandemic era when everybody was on Zoom and people were DJing.
Yeah.
One was we became friends.
Right.
We're pandemic friends.
We did a podcast on the phone every couple days for free.
I'd call with like 5 minutes. I'd be like, hey, this is a quick 2 minute question, and then I'd look at my phone later and it was like 2 hours.
Right.
But so our relationship kept, but one of my other favorite moments of the pandemic was when I was DJing and somebody added in the comments, they at Miss Mech from this group.
Mecca.
And she came into my DJ set.
Are you serious?
And she was just like, She was like, I appreciate, you know, you playing
so underrated.
some old classics. And I was just like, you know, 15-year-old me is flipping out because Miss Mecca is in my comments show. Like, I wanted to tell everybody to just start listening to the show just for that alone. I love Diggable Planets.
I love Diggable Planets. They're finally getting their flowers. They got some flowers back then. I think they won a Grammy, right? But, like, they kind of disappeared.
No, but they never...
Yeah.
Like, at the center of the culture the way the Tribe and De La...
Right.
I mean, like, I was actually talking about this to somebody recently. You know, he finally got to go see Diggable Planets, I think, like, in 1997. They were opening for Sade at Candlestick Park
gig.
But he was
what
like, I feel like... You know, considering where musically they were at, like, why didn't Tribe and, like, the Native Tongues crew, like, welcome them in? I don't want to take the credit for somebody else's brilliant observation, but my friend was like, it was almost like, you know, Bobby Rush in Chicago politics. He was like, don't bring us anybody we don't already know. Like, it was like they weren't part of the Native Tongues clique, and so they were not allowed to become a part of the Native Tongues.
They're from, like, Seattle, I think, or they're from the West Coast. They're not literally from the
East Coast. Ishmael Butler was from Washington, I want to say. And so he had moved to New York. And then Miss Mecca, I'm not sure what her backstory was. And then Doodlebug was, like, actually down with J.Ru the Damager. And, like, I feel like he was put with the other two because the label thought they'd be a good trio. But, I mean, like, yeah, Diggable, I mean...
But you're right. Are they a New York band? Kind of. I mean, their albums are about New York.
They were people who moved to New York, whereas Tribe, they're from Queens. You know, like, they're local dudes who, like, blew up on the New York scene. It is a little bit different, you know? But, I mean, like, Diggable, first album... Like, everybody heard it. Everybody had an opinion. I loved it. And then second album, I'm sure that label was like, oh, man, there's no, you know, slick like that on this album. But I think that second album needs a return listen. Some of the greatest sampling I've ever heard in a hip-hop album. Great, great choice, man. How did it change your relationship to music?
I think it changed my relationship to music just as a listener to be recognizing the use of the Rhodes electric piano as such a like core aspect of what ties together almost everything I love. And as a musician, I started to make music where that was the backbone. A lot of my music that I've made probably comes from recognizing that watery keyboard sound, that kind of, it sort of has an elongated and soft introduction. Like every time, every chord you play on the Rhodes is a bit softer as you attack the chord, and then it's got this watery elongated feeling. And this song is like the mastery of that. You really feel like you're submerged and only your eyes can see above, like a little bit, because
I like that imagery.
The languorous slow groove with that like insane meter sample. I'm a huge fan of the meters. The drum break is from the meters song, I think. Here Comes the Meter Man. I should double check that. But it's definitely Zigaboo Modaliste, who's my favorite in my top three drummers. I just put
the fact you pronounced that correctly.
Zigaboo Modaliste. What a name. And
a
what a drummer. He does that insane syncopated boom, ka, ka, boom, boom, ka, ka, dun, da, da, ka. It's insane. It's insane.
Yeah.
How syncopated it is. How not just boom, cat, boom, boom, cat. The opposite of just a simple funk beat comes into play here. And
you nailed it, because I think one of the things we're doing with this episode is we're talking about the ways that we came to know each other better. And one of the things I like about the way you talk about music is, like, you break it down by the bass line, by the drums. Like, you know, I hadn't ever heard anybody talk like that about music before. So I'm glad you're here.
I'm glad we're friends, too. I mean, that's what we're here for. And just to sort of finish my thoughts on this song, mm-hmm. one thing that I think is cool from a, like, what is happening creatively in the production process is they did something similar to Portishead in that there's a combination of samples and live instrumentation happening.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done some digging, and I think Dave Darlington, I think is the name of the producer. I want to get that right. But a lot of the, like, bass playing and Rhodes playing is actually not sampled. It just feels sampled. So you've got, on the bottom layer, you've got that meters drum beat.
Mm.
On top of that, you've got replayed, or I think created. I don't think they're replaying a sample. I think that's just a song they wrote with those chord changes. It feels, though, like the entire thing is a breakbeat. It feels like it could be a Bob James sample.
I totally agree.
Drums, the Rhodes, and the bass together, but it's not. And then on top of that is the rapping. So this sort of three layers is really cool when it's done.
Yeah, I remember the single off that album was Eighth Wonder, and I feel like sort of the same thing there. Eighth Wonder is a sample, but it also sounds like they've got some live instrumentation.
I think that bass line, the don't 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 don't.
Yeah,
don't, I love that.
But like
track.
That, but that song comes, like, as a DJ, like, that song comes in big, like, when it's got the wow 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 wow, like,
right.
You're like, as a DJ, like, you just want to open up a big music festival with that shit and just have the crowd be like, yeah,
right,
you know, like that.
Oh,
that's
right, because that's the, like, James Brown Funky People sample. That Public Enemy,
yeah, used for
later
Public
on.
Enemy number one, exactly.
Right. Yeah. Oh my God, all these—that's a huge part of what I love about, first of all, music, but talking about music with Diallo, and the appreciation of it all is, like, how these things are connected, how you get from one artist to the other, from one era to the other, and how it's a history lesson when you break apart these songs and you start to realize, oh, this is coming from that. And one thing I'll go to the mat on, and that's maybe one of the big themes that run through all of our episodes and seasons.
Go to the mat, man.
Going to the mat is that as a creative choice is so valuable to culture and at large. The idea that, like, reusing things not as what is some people consider laziness, but reusing and sampling comes out of an appreciation for and a re-upping of, a remember this of, a kind of pointing to what came before as an education process.
Absolutely.
I love that part of it. It's a conversation. So cool. Diggable Planets, one of my all-time favorites, Black Ego.
I'm with you.
Dial, I got a question for you.
Oh, damn.
What song did you choose?
Well, you know, the first song I chose is by an English synth pop duo.
Don't tell me. No, keep going with the hints and I'll see if I can guess.
Okay. These two, they met in 1981.
Okay, keep going.
They shared an affinity for disco and electropop records.
You know what's funny is so far that's still about 120 bands. Like, you've not narrowed it down. Keep going.
They're like, Flock of Seagulls. One part of their backstory that I like a lot is that they were apparently, like, reviewing songs by other artists when one of the people they reviewed was like, okay, so if you guys have such strong opinions, why don't you guys do better? And I feel like
I know
honestly,
who this is. Yeah, go on. No, I think I know who it is with that hint. That's
no, I mean,
one.
Like, seriously, it's almost the reason I found myself with a writing partner, Bashir Salahuddin, writing comedy, because we were critics, essentially, of other people's movies and TV shows. We were like, oh, man, you know, like.
And someone called you out on it and challenged you? Like,
well,
you
somebody was
you
like,
better.
Man, y'all think y'all could do better? You know, I don't know why I gave them that voice, because they never actually came at us that aggressively. But, you know, at some point we were like, you know, maybe we should do better. And my mom was actually the one who was like, you know, you guys should start writing comedy because you're funny. And now, you know, thanks, Mom. I'm glad you brought that up.
Sometimes critics push us into new areas.
Exactly,
yeah,
exactly. Sometimes
that's
a little bit of aggression
happens.
And adversity right. brings about, you know, some good times.
That's where the growth happens.
I'll give you one more hint. In 1983, the two recorded a track inspired in part by a T.S. Eliot poem.
No, I thought I had it. Now I've gone the other direction.
I lost your T.S.
I went the other direction. The Wasteland?
The song title is West End Girls, and the group
Oh my God,
is
the Pet Shop Boys.
The Pet Shop Boys.
I freaking love them.
Let's hear a little bit.
Neil Tennant used to write for, like, was it NME? Or I think he was a writer. He was a critic for NME.
Yeah, and let's see if we can listen to some of the young folks in the room who may not already know. Here is West End Girls by the Pet Shop Boys.
So sick.
Pure 1983 heat.
It stands the test of time, and yet it is so time-stamped.
It sounds so good.
It is so 1983.
You know, let me just say right off the bat that my first memory of this is I was sitting in elementary school, and I was, like, you know, singing this song, and, like, all the kids knew it because, you know, at that age, you're all listening to everything. But I'll never forget one girl saying, like, oh, man, you like white music?
Oh, you know? It's gotta be like that.
Oh, but this song is so good. I mean, like, I can remember in Atlanta where I grew up, like, there was definitely a line in the sand between the black stations and the pop stations. And so, yes, I did listen to V103, but I also did listen to, I don't remember what the call sign was for the white pop station, but that was where I got stuff like Pet Shop Boys and Swing Out Sister and, like, all these, like, groups from that era. And I just remember thinking at the time, and, like, most of the kids, even though they would clown me for listening to white music, we all thought it was rapping. That's what's interesting. In 1983...
Right. He is basically rapping.
He's basically rapping.
He's not really singing that song at all.
We didn't know Austin Powers yet, but it honestly sounded like if Austin Powers could rap. It's like, I'm telling you, better off dead. You know, like, it was just, you know, and I think about that. Like, it comes in hard. Like, Pet Shop, like, what's it called? Sometimes you're better off dead if there's a gun in your hand and it's pointed at your head. Like, woo!
That's like Grandmaster Flash. That's like the message.
There's drama. Is a person feeling suicidal? Like, what? It didn't even make sense to me, but I just knew that was some hard stuff for 1983. I just feel like this song was so cool, and I think the reason why it's personal for me is because it was one of the first times in my life that I was aware of the fact that I was listening to not just what my immediate friends in my elementary school classroom would listen to. I was listening to, you know, something that was different. And granted, it was a big pop song at the time, so it's not like I'm like a 8-year-old out there, you know, going through the record stacks, but it was one of the first times I was like, oh, I listened to a little bit of everything, you know. And now it's like a bragging right, you know, like everybody's like, oh, I listen to everything. But like in the 80s, like, you I love the movie SLC Punk, because they're like, the New Romantics hated the punks, and the punks hated, you know, the Grease, like, everything was divided so much by music, and it was definitely no different in Atlanta. But, you know, I just feel like it was a time when I was just discovering that there was a lot of music out
there.
So
was this song the one that broke through? And, like, before this, prior to this, maybe you felt like the music and the group that you were part of were connected, and suddenly you were like, there's something outside of this group, and I need to make a choice whether I'm going to go for it and be like, yes, I like things outside of the group, or no, you're right, this sucks.
I think it was, like I said, you know, your world in elementary school is the people that you're in that classroom with, you know, and it occurred to me that through my radio, through my alarm clock, which had in the radio right now, every Gen Z person is like, what? Those two devices were combined? my alarm clock had a radio, and whatever that pop station was, I was listening to that just as much as I was listening to, you know, the Black Radio station. So I, you know, at that time, like, Michael Jackson was probably getting played on both, you know what I mean? Prince was probably getting played on both, but, you know, Anita Baker wasn't getting paid on both. Right. You know what I mean?
Right,
like,
right.
And so I had my Anita Baker side, but I also had, you know, Pet Shop Boys, and, you know, Oingo Boingo was like something that I really seemed to like a lot back in the days, mainly because, you know, his songs, you know, Danny Elfman's songs were getting into movies like Back to School with Rodney Dangerfield. You know what I mean?
Oh, that's where,
like,
you hear them?
Yeah, yeah. Like, I would hear a song either on that pop radio station or in a movie and think, oh, I really like Burning Down the House because my parents let me watch, you know, Revenge of the Nerds before I was ready to watch it.
Well, it's so interesting that, like, that's that. First of all, I love this song. I love your choice. And I'm thinking about how interesting it is, because that era of music of what was on the pop charts, which had come out of kind of, a lot of it was coming out of a post-punk movement, which was the integration in rock music of lots of things that came from dance music and came from black music and came from disco.
Yeah.
and come from reggae. Like if you think like Culture Club, those are reggae songs.
That's crazy, right?
Right.
Culture Club and the Police were clearly are doing reggae, influenced by reggae
and dub reggae.
And I think about it, I wasn't really into like Guns N' Roses and
but that's what I'm saying. Like the
Bon
rock,
Jovi. That was. I mean, I heard those songs too, but that wasn't my thing. I really liked stuff on keyboards and synthesizers. You know, Hall & Oates. I always talk about the fact that you and I both agree. You can play Hall & Oates for almost any type of music fan, and that shit goes over big. You know, like there's something about Hall & Oates that just crosses so many lines.
Right. And one thing that all of those acts share is how rhythmic it is, meaning the drums and bass matter. And there are syncopated rhythms in the bass. Like that really basic thing carries through in a way very differently from just the guitar-driven rock music that came before. And the tempos are more danceable. Like a lot of what was integrated into white music, into white pop music, especially the British invasion, humanly kind of era stuff, where Pet Shop Boys fit, you know, perfectly, and Duran Duran, all of those guys.
I'm surprised that nobody has done anything with West End Girls. I feel like you could take their vocals out and put Luther Vandross over it, and it would make sense.
Yeah,
like because that bass line is so throaty,
so wobbly, it's so dope. Wobbly and dope. That song's produced also by Bobby Orlando, who did like The Flirts. You know that song?
I know The Flirts.
There's that song that Felix the House Cat samples.
Passion. For those listening, Passion is a great Italian disco song. The genre is called Italo disco, but it's a great Italian disco song. If you get 2 seconds, go on YouTube, find The Flirts. The name of the song is Passion. And you'll probably hear some connective tissue between that and West End Girls.
That song is so sick, but used as a sample on this track, which I'll play, transforms
it. One
of my favorite combinations. So here's Felix the House Cat with Miss Kitten sampling that song we just heard by The Flirts.
Pleasure in limousine, in the back shakes a tambourine, nicotine from silver screen.
I get so hyped when I hear that track.
Great song.
Both of them are great. So that's Bob. That's the Bobby O connection, who produced and co-wrote that Pet Shop
Something
Boys
I am
song.
Learning today. Thank you, my friend. This is why we talk.
Go look up when you get home. There's a demo version on YouTube. That's the prior to the release version of West End Girls. That's a little more Bobby O sounding with that bouncy boom. So go check it.
I'll definitely check that demo
of West End Girls. Bobby Orlando.
So that was my first song. It had a big impact on me. What's your second song?
Well, my next song is a song that stopped me in my tracks when I first heard it. I literally felt like I couldn't move. It's by a British band out of Bristol. Hint, hint, hint. That actually narrows it down to three, right? The three big Bristol bands.
I think
you may know it. Whose debut album, Dummy, was a commercial and critical success. The band is Portishead. The song is 1994's Pedestal. So just listening back to that track, I'm remembering, I mean, it just instantly transports me back in time, as music wonderfully does so often. But one thing that struck me on this listen is the bass line. It goes up that half step, and it's a certain frequency. I'm going to stop right there with the word frequency in science-y stuff, partially because it's kind of like, you know, it's a little bit beyond the scope of the show, but I also don't know it that well. I'm not a scientist of sound, but I do know that certain frequencies can, like, make you poop, and certain frequencies can make you just stop dead in your tracks.
That what they call the brown note?
That's the brown note.
Oh, my God.
That's the brown
that was
note.
An urban legend.
No, I don't know if it is, but I read about it in a Tintin a long time ago, so it must be true. And
you're like, all I know is I always shit whenever I hear that sound.
That Portishead, the production on that is so insane that they have somehow captured this one bass note where I can't move. It's like I am in the sunken place of sound while that song is playing. It's really like a dream where you're like, you see things happening and you just can't do anything. So another wonderful thing that I was thinking as we just listened back was the line that she sings. And she's barely singing. That's a wonderful thing about Beth Gibbons is her voice is like, she's kind of, it's like Amy Mann. She's one of those singers who's, she's obviously singing, but it's like, she's not belting it. She's not Chaka Khaning it. She's kind of like, just singing it like this. really close to the mic. If microphones weren't invented, she couldn't be a singer. Like, she's one of those kind of crooner types. But she's about to sing You Abandoned Me, How I Suffered. And that line, just like when I first heard it, I was going through a breakup. It was really dark. She wasn't calling me back. And to the present day, it still is kind of a marker of very sad moments. Very recently, I had something happen. Everything's fine now. But I put that record on. I made the mistake of putting that record on. And I was crying. I was bawling in midday on a Tuesday. It's
crying
just got that
Tuesday?
power of the emotional content of both her voice and the bass.
I love a good lyric that, if you know, like we all hear, you know, I was talking to Kevin Hart just recently. He was like, anytime he tries to sing, he always starts with the word girl. So it's always like, girl. and then whatever follows after that. But
that's brilliant,
shout out to Kevin.
Good creative technique. Yeah.
But one thing, I like a lyric that's like incredibly sad or dark, and it just, you know, I remember on that recent Everything But the Girl song, Nothing Left to Lose, she sings, "Kiss me while the world decays." Like, I was just like, oh, like what a gut punch that is. So I've been there.
Yeah.
I've been there when that one lyric is just like, I can't believe this is happening. Marvin Gaye's got some lyric. In the song, I think, What's Happening, Brother? Or it's on What's Going On, but it's the line where he says, he's talking about war is hell, when will it end? You know, and he's talking about all this stuff that sucks. And he's like, oh, and by the way, how the hell have you been? There's something about the way he sings, how the hell have you been? It's so heartbreaking.
Wow.
Because you get the sense that he's like really feeling it. And this other person he's talking to is probably really feeling it, but he's checking in with him all the same.
Wow.
So the power of a lyric.
Right.
Sometimes.
I was thinking, as you said, the Marvin Gaye sounds like the zooming out on the awful, but then like the zooming in on the
personal.
Yeah,
he's been talking about, how's our team doing? You know, do you think they stand a chance? You know, like he's saying about singing about everything else happening in the world, but then he zooms in out of nowhere and he's like, and by the way, brother, how the hell have you been? I'm not going to hit falsetto.
No, that was beautiful. It moved me.
But he hits that hell.
I felt moved.
And you feel, you feel moved.
There's something really powerful about a voice in your ear, as we ourselves are right now to the listeners out there whose ears we are tickling with our flights of fancy, of prose about music, dancing about architecture.
Yes.
But it is powerful, endlessly powerful. And the reason why I love music so much, especially recordings, like recorded music is a beautiful phenomenon because a recording from 20, 30, 40, whatever years ago can have an emotional resonance throughout your entire life.
Absolutely.
And it's like a rock that stays consistent for you. It's something you can rely on.
One thing about Portishead, number one, I always liked Portishead. Portishead, Massive Attack, without stepping too far outside the genre. I even put some of the Primal Scream stuff in there. And I feel like DJ Shadow was big in that time. Like, there were a lot of people who were sort of
Kruder and Dorfmeister.
They were all sort of, in my view, sort of just east of hip-hop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, they were sampling. It was very moody in the way that 90s hip-hop was very moody. And even though they were selling, it wasn't like in your face pop, you know, like it was.
Right. I'm just making the connection now as you're saying it. It's the same thing that happened in West End Girls.
Yes.
Which is that
the British
white people, British white people started to bring in a more recent black music phenomenon of hip hop. So it's the tempos, it's the break beats, and they're singing their white people songs on top of it. And that's its own beautiful format, but how interesting that it's connected to the other one.
It turns out white people doing black music sells well.
This didn't just happen once. This didn't just happen once.
But that is a great group. And I honestly wish I knew them a little bit better because I feel like I know sort of the big Portishead songs. I don't know like the smaller ones.
Yeah.
Even Massive Attack, I consider myself a fan. You know, I know Teardrop and some of their other songs, but it's not... You know, maybe because it wasn't made to be a radio single. I don't know
the songs. I'll make another connection to my previous song, by the way, that I've just thought of about Portishead, is they did a similar phenomenon, but they went a step further in terms of sampling. They didn't sample anything. I take that back. I think on their record they have maybe two or three samples, but everything that sounds sampled in most of their work is themselves jamming, and then recording the jam and then pressing up an acetate, an actual vinyl copy of their jam.
So they basically made a record of them playing something so they could manipulate it like they were sampling.
Precisely. And so the aesthetic quality of the sound would feel like the samples that had been in the culture for the previous 10 years, which are sampled off of wax.
I really want to make an acetate now.
It's so cool.
That's the coolest thing I've ever
heard. It is pretty cool that they did that, yeah. And it also avoids the whole, I haven't said it this episode, so I have to, interpolate.
It was interpolate. They were interpolating themselves.
They were interpolating themselves. They're a little bit interpolating themselves, but they're avoiding the sampling interpolation side of hip hop that can get other people into hot water.
Absolutely.
They did license the one or two samples they do use on that record. But anyway, Portishead, such a thread through my life.
Every college student had that CD, I feel like.
And they had that Robert Doisneau poster with the Kiss.
Yes.
So, Diallo, what's your second song?
This next song, is from a group. To me, it changed the way I heard hip-hop. In fact, I can remember sitting in my friend's car, and he was like, yo, check this out. I just heard this while I was up in New York. And I remember him popping in the tape because it was a cassette deck. And I remember being moved and wanting to get into a fight, I was so hype. But at the same time, I was like, is this even hip-hop? Because it just didn't sound like anything that we had ever heard.
I have no idea what this is. I'm so excited.
Oh my gosh. You got just some play hints it. For me? I'm not just even gonna say
it. What's a hint? I need a hint. I probably won't know it.
Quentin Tarantino became a friend
of
one of the members, famously.
I don't know.
Later.
DMX.
Later in the decade.
I can see Quentin and DMX being buddies.
That'd be interesting.
I have no idea who this is. I'm excited.
Oh my God.
Give me a hint. I need a hint.
I'm excited to play it for you.
Okay.
But I can't play it until after the break.
Oh, you tease.
Thanks to the U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Just like notes in a song, sustainable living is just a series of small, eco-friendly choices that contribute to the melody. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on At Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
What kind of fun is waiting for you at Kings Island? The holy cow, we're way too high and here comes the drop kind of fun. The make a splash all summer kind of fun. The I can't believe I ate that whole funnel cake. Let's get another kind of fun. But most importantly, at Kings Island, you'll find for the fun of it kind of fun.
Don't wait to start your fun this season. Kings Island is now open weekends.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
Meet the next generation of podcast stars with SiriusXM's Listen Next program, presented by State Farm. As part of their mission to help voices be heard, State Farm teamed up with SiriusXM to uplift diverse and emerging creators. Tune in to Stars and Stars with Issa as host Issa Nakazawa dives into birth charts of her celeb guests. This is just the start of a new wave of podcasting. Visit statefarm.com to find out how we can help prepare for your future. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Welcome back to One Song, the show where we deconstruct and celebrate some of our favorite songs from the past 60 years and tell you why it deserves one more listen. Before the break, Diallo was just about to tell us which song changed his life.
I mean, it definitely changed my relationship to hip-hop because I was like, man, if they're making hip-hop that's produced and sounds like this, anything is possible. This is a hip-hop group out of Staten Island whose members include Method Man, Ghostface, Old Dirty Bastard.
Staten Island is all I needed.
Yeah. You got GZA, the RZA, Inspector Deck, Raekwon the Chef. You know, so many members. I mean, like, I don't think there was a black group with this many members since the Commodores had like 26 dudes on stage.
Clinton had like 50 on stage. Yeah.
I always used to joke that, like, when Lionel was like introducing the rest of the group, like, he had to set aside the last 25 minutes of the performance. Like, there were so many Commodores. In fact, I'm convinced there were so many Commodores. Lionel was like, you know what? I'm gonna do this next album by myself.
Hello. Much introducing.
The group is, of course, Wu-Tang Clan, and the song, there were a lot of songs, but this one I just remember very clearly. The song is Protect Your Neck.
I'm kicking the Lone Ranger, co-ed.
Danger!
Deep in the dark with the art to rip the charts apart, the vandal. Too hot to handle your battle.
You're saying goodbye like Tevin Campbell. Oh my God. It's always crazy to me. We were just talking about lyrics. It's always crazy to me that somewhere in this brain, you know, like, I had to remember the names of my kids. I had to remember, like, the combination to a door. And somewhere is filed away almost every single lyric on Enter the 36 Chambers. Yeah, almost every single one.
You might need it at some point.
I mean,
so it's
yes,
useful
yes.
information. Yeah.
They're going to be like, we have a gun to your head, comrade. Now recite perfectly the torture sketch. And I would. I'd be able to be like, torture, motherfucker, torture. You know, like, I don't even know if Sirius allows this
You'd
much
survive.
Profanity.
You would survive in a test like that, so you're safe.
Look, man, I'm telling you, Protect Your Neck, all I can remember straight up was, like, nothing sounded like this. Like, they didn't sample James Brown, you know? Shout out to EPMD and everybody who sampled James. They didn't sample James Brown. Or if they did, it was completely, you couldn't make it out in the song. Like, they were sampling weird, you know, martial arts exploitation films. You know, they were sampling the Charmels. They were sampling some really obscure stuff and chopping it up in ways, shout out to the RZA, chopping it up in ways that we had just never heard before. I mean, you know, this was hip hop in the 90s. It was the intro to a culture. It was all about being, you know, part of that 5%, you know, nation in New York. And I was there for it. It was just, you know, it blew my mind.
And the whole conceptual thing, the whole, like, there's so much lore. There's so much lore involved.
Yes.
That was crafted.
Now, let me say this. Before Wu-Tang Clan, there was Fushnikins, which is a forgotten group from the 90s. And I remember initially among me and my friends, they were like, oh, Wu-Tang Clan, they just copying Fushnikins. You know, like, and now it's like, how many people remember, you know, I am a true, what? I am a true Fushnik. How many people even remember that? But you got to remember, there was not a lot of, like, nowadays, you know, we've got these streamers and, you know, you can watch so much stuff from so many decades. But back in the day, like, on Saturday afternoons, there was only Godzilla movies and these kung fu flicks, you know? And so we'd all seen these flicks, and the idea that somebody was sampling them and putting them with, like, samples of, like, Voltron cartoons, like, it was almost like an early introduction to the culture of black nerds. Shout out to all the black nerds out there. Like, you know, we were not trying to, like, play NWA, because that was the pop hip-hop of the time. But, like, this felt underground, and this felt, like, catered to us. You know what I mean? I mean,
that's,
you got
so cool.
Method Man. He literally, you know, it's such a beautiful double entendre. Like, on the one hand, Meth, that was like a slang at the time for, like, marijuana. But also, he had listened to Method of Modern Love by Hall & Oates, once again, crossing the line.
Which he interpolates,
you know,
in that track,
which
too.
Which he interpolates on the track. Like, it was just, oh, you know, I'm just saying, like, the Wu-Tang, they spoke to us, you know? Like, it was nerdy music.
Right. I've got such a question about the lore aspect of it. Was that part of what drew you in? Was it appealing to you that there was more than the music? There's the gang, there's the nine of them, there's sort of the troop, the coolness of
amazing.
A group of,
I mean,
people.
Like, I think it was easily the biggest crew at a time when every hip-hop video had, like, the rapper or, like, the rappers in the front of, like, 80 dudes, you know, like, all standing in the background, like, waving their hands from side to side.
It sort of implies that there's, like, a story behind it that you're curious to know more about.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the idea of having a posse and having all, you and all your boys around, but it wasn't just one of you rapping, it might be two of you, it might be three of you. Wu-Tang was the first to say, no, everybody gets a verse. Everybody, we're going to have nine verses on this
and
song.
You're going to wait till we're done.
And you just have to be there for every verse.
Right.
And to this day, I can walk up to a black, I feel like I could walk up to any black dude of a certain age and just start rapping the lines that open up Wu-Tang Triumph, and they'll go along with me. You know, I can walk up like, you know, like, I bomb atomically, Sophocles' philosophies and hypotheses could be bombed. Like, motherfuckers start losing their mind, and it's because we know all those Wu-Tang lyrics. I see somebody in the studio, like, just going like, yeah. Like, it's just something about knowing Wu-Tang lyrics. Like, they were just, they were writing lyrics. You got to also realize where we are. This is right before Outkast comes out. So, like, we've been treated to the I would say, the NWA, you know, early Dr. Dre sound of the West Coast. We definitely have Pete Rock and CL Smooth, which is, you know, DJ Pete Rock's the producer there. Guru, DJ Premier, he's got a sound. You know, they're very distinct sounds. RZA was on none of that shit.
Yeah.
You know, like, he had absolutely his own sound. This is before
Outkast.
This isn't
that jazzy tribe and
no,
diggable stuff we were
talking
about.
No, this isn't jazzy.
Yeah.
This is like, it feels like punk, you know, but from a black point of view.
Well, you mentioned Public Enemy. It seems to have a connection to that lineage, too.
But see, I would say the Public Enemy is more the Bomb Squad, and it didn't sound like the Bomb Squad either. It really was just its own, because it's so stripped down. In a weird way, it's the anti-Bomb Squad, because the Bomb Squad was so layered, and it had so many different things. That, like, when you go back and listen to those Public Enemy records, which I love, they've got, like, 30 uncleared samples.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
But with the RZA, like, it's not just what he sampled, it's the space he leaves in between the beat. Like, if you listen to Protect Your Neck, or if you listen to Cream, or so many of those early, you know, Wu-Tang tracks, like, it's the space in between that feels very Spartan. And I think that's what sounded almost eerie and haunting and almost like horror movie about those early.
Right.
You know, and again, I'm in Atlanta. This is before Andre and Big Boy start Outkast. Like, we're just not used to these sounds. The sounds were just out of the box.
Right.
It was just different.
That's so cool. This is so awesome, Diallo. I'm learning so much about you. And I thought I knew you so well before, but this is like another layer of richness to our friendship.
My man, Luxury, what is your third song?
I wonder if you can guess. I'm not sure that you know that I even like this
band.
Give me
one hint, and it can be a really obscure hint.
All right, well, it's Los Angeles.
Okay, Los Angeles.
L.A. and its band.
L.A. band, Red Hot Chili Peppers.
It's not the Chili Peppers. You're not wrong in terms of the cohort.
The Doors.
You went back too far. Right cohort, though. The Chili Peppers were in the crew.
Rage Against the Machine.
All right, we're going the wrong direction now. No, here's what's going on here. The last song I chose, Diallo, is probably the song that's impacted me the most out of these three, at least emotionally, maybe not as much musically. It's a band that rose to fame on the LA rock scene in the late 80s, and the song itself is a bittersweet ode to lost loved ones. It's called Then She Did by Jane's Addiction.
You know, one of the reasons I look forward to our conversations is because you know bands that I know, but don't know super well. And I feel like Jane's Addiction is one of those.
I'm about to blow your mind. Not only is this band, but Blake, this guy, Luxury's real name, Blake, when he was before Luxury, I was so obsessed with this band that I had dreadlocks. And I had the little metal things in the dreadlocks, just like the lead singer, Perry Farrell.
Oh, wow.
The obsession was sad. Not sad. I'm going to be kind to my younger self. It was very deep, though. This song.
It was pure.
It was very pure. And I think it's not insignificant that this song hit me in my teen years, because I just really connected to that. We were talking about sort of the tribal aspect of bands with Wu-Tang, the tribal aspect of the band Jane's Addiction. I wanted to be in the band. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be all of the performers. I was also learning instruments. And I can say, like, as I think about it, actually, I was going to say the drummer really influenced me, but all four band members, their influence on my particular connection to the instrument: Eric Avery on bass, Stephen Perkins on drums, Dave Navarro on guitar.
Oh,
and of
Dave,
course, Perry
Dave Navarro
Farrell.
In this band. I totally forgot about that.
They all had massive influence on me at an impressionable young musician age, because they were bringing all these elements together. They've got some very clear, there's some Led Zeppelin in there, there's some this, there's some that. But also, I'll just never forget, like, I read this interview with Dave Navarro when he talks about, as he's an insane guitar player, he's one of our greatest living guitar players, but he's he's a little bit humble about the guitar playing because it's a lot about the chest and the tattoos. But I really loved the man, and he said something that really influenced me, where he's talking about how Robert Smith from The Cure is one of his biggest guitar influences. And Robert Smith from The Cure is not much of a guitar player. He's a competent player of the instrument. But his point was, like, you don't have to be great to write great songs.
To be emotive with it.
And, oh, my God, that made such an impression on Young Luxury's life, to be like, this rock god is saying you don't have to be a rock god to make music. So that was a huge thing for me. With this song in particular and that moment of it, like, I'm glad we played that snippet and not the one at the end, because I would burst into tears again. Why, these are all the songs that make me cry that I chose. I'm just noticing.
A lot of people are listening on their radio, so you can cry all you want.
Okay. Well, the tears will be tears of emotional joy and breakthrough. It's a song about his mom who committed suicide when he was a kid. And it's really, the lyrics are so much more poignant when you know that. But you don't need to know the story to kind of feel that that's what it's about. Mm-hmm. And I had a friend who passed away, who committed suicide a few years ago. And when I recently listened to it, it kind of piled
all that stuff back.
And I had another Tuesday cry on the couch when I was listening back to the song a few weeks ago. And so it just reminded me of, like, again, the beauty of why music is good and important in life, because it can stir emotions. And that's everything to me. Like, I think for some people it's film, and I'm certainly capable of feeling emotion from a film, but the emotion that I feel from a song is its own kind of thing. And
this song
has so much that it carries with it.
It's so interesting, because I think we take our musical taste wherever we go, and, you know, like, you know, it's not one of the songs that I picked, but and some people would probably find this really weird, but the Underworld song, the Underworld is like a dance group, but their song Cherry Pie, is it Cherry or Cherry Pie, I forget, but the first time I heard it, I got chills. You know what I mean? And it's, and then, you know, That's when music works, right?
Chills from music. It's like it bypasses the brain, the, like,
makes
logical
no sense
thinking.
In some ways,
goes straight to the heart.
There aren't even any lyrics to Cherry Pie, and I think that, you know, it's clearly just something that the music is doing that's making me feel something primal that is in there. But, you know, talking about Jane's Addiction, I always liked Jane's Addiction. Anytime I heard Jane's Addiction, I liked it. Like, Been Caught Stealing, like, it's got this bass line that's, like, kind of aggressive and hard. And then Perry's voice comes in, I was listening once when I was five. You know, like, you're like, that's not the voice I expected over these guitars, you know? There's that. And can I just admit, one of my absolute favorite songs of the 90s is Pets by Porno for Pyrex.
Yes. Underrated,
you know, who plays the guitar on that? Because that, like, that's one of my favorite sort of, like, can almost give me chills if I'm in the right move sort of things. I guess it may not be his Jane's Addiction.
Well, it's half of Jane's Addiction. It's the side project. It's him and again, on drums, Stephen Perkins, who's in my top three. My top three drummers of all time are Stephen Perkins, Zigaboo Modaliste. So we got two out of three of them today. And the third one would be John Bonham from Led Zeppelin. He's probably my number one.
Oh, fantastic.
Drums are my first instrument. That was the first thing I learned to play.
And that was something we only learned recently that we had in common, was that, you know, we both started our music paths as drummers.
What are your top three drummers?
Oh, well, that's, now you've put me on the spot. I'm going to not come up with the cool answers. I'm going to come up with the truthful answers. The first drummer.
What are you implying? Mine were truthful.
The first drummer I fell in love with was Animal from the Muppets. I'm telling you, I don't know who. I know he's based on Keith Moon.
Beats.
I know he's based on Keith Moon, but Animal was like, I was like, I want to play that instrument because he's crazy and I want to be crazy too.
That's awesome.
I told you, I'm going to answer completely truthful. Questlove.
That's
because
actually pretty cool, though.
I thought Questlove was great before I met him. The very first time I actually talked to him, he was standing outside of Tower Records in Atlanta by Atlantic Square Mall, and I recognized him, and he had the big fro back then, and I walked up, and I was like, hey man, I really think Do You Want More is a great album. And he was like, oh, yo, that's cool, man. He had his, you know, he had a bunch of records on his arm. He talked to us, you know, nobodies for like 5 minutes.
That's,
you know,
awesome.
And I was just like, and then I had no idea that years later I would be a writer on Fallon working with him for 4 years. And then after that, oh gosh, I, you know, let me hold off on that, because I feel like there's somebody who I'm 100% forgetting. But you know who is Quincy Jones's drummer on Off the Wall and Thriller? I feel like should know who that is.
I think it might be John Robinson, but I...
Oh my God, John Robinson.
Very, wow, you just pulled that out of thin air.
Every now and then, the brain works
I'm
like
impressed.
Google.
I'm very impressed.
Yeah, John Robinson, I think it has to be up there just because he did so many iconic... It's really easy to forget that, you know, it's the same reason why I feel like people should not rag on Ringo Starr. It's hard for a drummer to both come up with like iconic drumming, but also not get in the way of everything else that's happening. And I feel like that's the case with Ringo Starr. I feel like that's the case with John Robinson.
Frankly, Meg White deserves her flowers.
Hell yeah.
That
Love
band,
Meg White.
It would make no sense with like a drummer that was doing the typical thing in the typical way would be boring. Part of what gives that band character.
Love Meg White.
Meg White.
No, she's great.
White Stripes.
Jane's Addiction.
Yeah, Jane's Addiction, man. I knew. I hope the shock has worn off that was one of my selections. But
I'd love you to give me like a playlist of like some Jane's album. Not Jane Says, which I think is a beautiful song about kicking an addiction.
Right.
but give me like three or four album cuts.
Happy to, yeah.
After the show that I should listen to because I feel like I would like. You know, and my last sort of like Perry Farrell thing that I have to bring up is that one of the first concerts I ever went to was Lollapalooza 2 back when it was still touring the country.
Yeah.
And I went to go see Ice Cube. But I'll never forget as I sat all the way in the back towards the fence waiting for Ice Cube to come on, a band I'd never heard of was singing at Lollapalooza 2. And I was like, oh, this sounds pretty good. And that guy's got a good voice. And it was Pearl Jam. I had never heard of the group before, and I went out and bought 10 the same day, and I really got into grunge. You know, not that I hadn't been into a little bit. You know, Nirvana Smells Like Teen Spirit was like the song that ate radio that year. But when I
heard
10,
I'm holding my tongue
a
little
like,
bit.
I really loved
I want to get
so
into
much.
It with you at some point about Pearl Jam, because I'm going to hold my tongue a little bit. But mm-hmm. Pearl Jam, I have another list that Pearl Jam falls on.
Okay.
Along with The Killers. These are bands that I... for many years have tried, and I just can't find my way in. So maybe you'll make that playlist
for me and bring me into the Pearl Jam universe. I mean, it's one of those things
I have not
listened to 10 probably in 20 years, but I remember loving 10 at the time. And I remember loving Blood Sugar Sex Magik by the Chili Peppers. That was the year I got my first car. So I was driving around playing a lot of those bands.
Yeah, me too, actually. But I wasn't playing the Pearl Jam, but maybe you will bring me, because sometimes with a band, all it takes is someone to introduce you to that, right?
Yeah.
Right song at the right context, and you know, maybe it's time for me to open my
mind. I should
probably
listen to it again. I might go back and listen. There are some bands that I used to love. I've gone back and listened to their records recently. I'm like, this isn't as good as I remember.
Right.
But we'll jump it at 10.
So that was Jane's Addiction, and those are my songs. Diallo, we got one more, and I can't wait to hear what you have for your final selection.
Listen, we've been talking about the songs that have had the biggest impact on us, and my next and final song is by a producer who's been making hit music for decades. He's a 13-time Grammy Award-winning producer who in 1999, do you know who it is yet? Who in 1999 teamed up with Chad Hugo.
Oh,
you
well,
know who this
obviously.
Is.
Obviously.
Okay. And drummer Shay Haley to form N.E.R.D., No One Ever Really Dies. The artist we're referring to is Pharrell of the Neptunes. And the track is... Everyone Knows, All the Girls Standing in the Line for the Bathroom. Okay, so a couple of quick things. Number one, the very first time I heard this song, I was in an all-black club. But by the time this song came out, I'm going to have to do the math. I think I'm 31. I think I'm 32. And this song came on in an all-back club. But I was aware that I was like maybe just a little bit older than the 24 and 25-year-olds in the club. This song came on. Everybody knew every single word to it already. And I was just like, where have I been? Like, I know I have a job, you know, but like, where was I when everybody was learning all these lyrics? And it was the first time in my life, and sadly it was not the last. It was the first time I realized I was not the youngest person in the club anymore.
Oh, man.
You know what I mean? Like, It really was, but
that's a tough moment in every man's
life. It's a tough time in anybody's life, but I also knew what made the song brilliant because I feel like it was the previous summer that I had gotten a membership card at a place called the Spider Club. And the Spider Club was this club above the Avalon Theater here in Hollywood. And I don't know how I got the membership card. Probably scammed my way in somehow, but it was like a place you could go and every Friday or Saturday night, you would see like the Lindsay Lohans and you would see all these people in there. And it was a crazy hip hop party where they took a lot of hip hop and mixed in like a little bit of like the Killers or the Rapture,
like the DJ
some of the
AM
hipster
era.
Stuff. It's the DJ AM era of Hollywood nightlife,
yeah.
Which sort of found its climax with Banana Split on Sundays at, I think the club was called LAX. And, you know, this was like at a time when hipster culture and hip hop culture was really, really merging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, out of this sort of cultural stew, we got Kid Cudi, whose song Day and Night to me encapsulates that period because Day and Night, sort of like this song, it didn't feel like mainstream hip hop radio. It felt like it was paying attention to what was happening in, you know, the electronic world where Daft Punk was really big by this point, and in the hipster world where, like I said, you know, anything from like, you know, the Killers to Hot Hot Heat, like we were all sort of going to each other's parties. And yes, there were a lot of drugs at, you know, these parties. So when I heard Everyone Knows, I was like, Pharrell is talking. Yeah, knows spelled like N-O-S-E. Like, I was like, yeah, Pharrell tapped into whatever Hollywood swinging was in the late 70s. Like, that sounds like going out in Hollywood in the late 70s.
Yeah.
This was what it was like going out in Hollywood, 2006, 2007.
Oh,
Everyone knows.
I missed it. I feel like I missed that. I missed New York, the Meet Me in the Bathroom
Just
era.
Hang out
I
with
missed,
me, man.
I missed all the
I'm
cool
where every
eras.
Scene is at right
now. I was
now.
Too young. I wasn't born yet for like the Andy Warhol, like that scene.
No, it
I missed all
fun, It was
all
a fun ass scene. I always say that, like, you know, as a comedy writer and as a you know, as a filmmaker, I hope to capture the energy. The very first time I heard another seminal song for this period, D-A-N-C-E by Justice.
Yeah.
I remember the first time that Steve Aoki put that on at Banana Split. Everybody was really excited because it had actually come out on the this is the blog house here. It had actually hit really big on Hype Machine earlier that
Hype
week.
Machine?
So
Why
everybody was like listening
backs.
To Dance by Justice and thinking like, yo, I can't wait till I hear this for the first time in the club. And then the first time he put it on, I'll never forget this because, you know, Lindsay was like friends with Aoki and AM. And Lohan like jumps out onto the dance floor and starts dancing like a freaking maniac. And like the dance floor parted, not because she was Lindsay Lohan. She had a red hoodie on. I'll never forget. She had a red hoodie on. Unless you'd already known that she had
American
come in
Apparel
a red hoodie.
Wasn't
you didn't know it.
That was an American Apparel hoodie, wasn't
People,
it?
It probably was. People were clearing the dance floor because who's this crazy maniac dancing like this, dancing hard and clearing the dance floor. But it was the first time we heard, do the D-A-N-C-E.
I was not expecting a Lindsay Lohan anecdote.
Where I didn't know it was coming up either.
Was there, do you have a Paris Hilton anecdote too?
Paris, you know what? Nobody sweated her. In fact, I remember one time I was DJing at a club and she came up into the DJ booth with her laptop, big bulky laptop. And she was like, can you show me how to hook this up? The owner wants me to play like some songs. So we had to like stop what we were doing, hook everything up for her. And she had like, I'm going to start some beef with Paris. So she didn't know how to hook anything up.
Oh, man.
You know, we had great
Paris,
female DJs in that time. Samantha Ronson was amazing. But Samantha was old school. Samantha would actually still show up with like a crate of records. You know what I mean? And she'd dump the records down.
Yeah.
And she'd be like,
Real
I got
deal.
My own needles. And she would go chop, 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 chop. And she would start spinning. And like, props to her. You know, her and Mark Ronson were great DJs. But like, Paris, that was the beginning of the
celebrity
DJ who can't hook up shit in the booth.
But they get people to the club.
But, well, not that night because she was a surprise DJ.
Oh, right.
So much a surprise that I didn't know she was coming. You know, shout out to Boulevard 3. That was a hot, you know, nightclub at the time. It's where I met my wife. You know, shout out to my wife, Brittany. Listening, hopefully.
I do not have a Paris Hilton anecdote to match that one, but I almost did, and I'm kicking myself because there was a Hilton ad on TikTok, and I was recruited as one of the influencers to be in this ad.
And did you refuse?
No, but I set my price. We did the negotiation, and they went another direction. I'm using air quotes right now. So I was so excited to come with a Paris Hilton story at some point.
I will just say that, you know, to me, Pharrell and NERD they were always exactly where the Hollywood party time zeitgeist was from the time they dropped the first album. The first time I saw Von Dutch hat, feel like it was like
you're
the
throwing
very
out all
next,
the 2006
listen,
stuff.
The very next week, I'm an intern. Like I'm barely getting paid any money. I'm an intern at Virgin Records, and they were like, "Hey, here's the Neptunes album." They didn't even call it the NRD. They were like, "Here's the Neptunes album." And I saw that cover with dude wearing, you know, the hat with the
Trucker
brain
hats
on it, playing video games. And I was like, "This is hot." And all the label execs were like, "I don't know. This seems like a really weird. We want Pharrell on the cover, not." I think that's Shay on the cover. I could be wrong. I think that's him on it. Like, you know, the whole album did. They wanted basically what he had done for Jay-Z and everybody else up till then, Nori. They wanted that as a hip-hop album, sort of to go up against another similar hip-hop album, the Violator Volume 1 album, which was also like sort of like, hey, here's some of our favorite producers working with a whole bunch of artists. No, NERD, they were always looking forward. And
totally.
They called the Von Dutch hats. They called, you
right.
know, the sort of hipster
side,
weirdness and the American
side, right.
apparel stuff
right.
that was coming.
Right.
So, you know, I had to put this one on there because, you know, this to me was sort of like a soundtrack to me living in L.A. and going to parties in the 2000s.
And Pharrell is such a genius. I'm such a fan. And, like, that song is such a testament to his genius. Because
yes.
it sounds like it's similar to the Portishead story. It sounds like there's lots of samples getting chopped up. But that's all stuff that he played.
I bet you a lot of it is just original
up.
Stuff. Yeah.
He's got his Triton. He's playing his buckets for the beats.
Yeah.
And it's just the way it's produced is to make it sound as though it's got the texture and the aesthetic resonance of an actual sample.
Yeah.
But it was original material that they just, like, chopped up and self-appropriated for the track.
Yeah. So that was NERD. Everyone knows all the girls standing in the line.
I love
the
all
bathroom.
Those stories, too.
Really,
I love
really long title. Really long title.
2006 encapsulated. Wow.
Luxury, has been so great getting to know you a little better today.
This has been super fun. I have to say that I had no idea about the songs you were going to pick, and it was really fun hearing you talk about them. Yeah. I feel like I have another layer of understanding about the Diallo.
There were some surprises in there. I can't believe I thought you were going to say The Clash somewhere in there, but
really?
Portishead, big surprise. Jane's Addiction. You know, again, it's one of those groups I feel like a lot of us know, but we don't really know. You know, sort of like how you and I know each other, but
right.
we don't really know each other.
Yeah, and I felt the same way when you selected, like, Pet Shop Boys. I really love that Pet Shop Boys, they almost feel like you're Jane's Addiction. Like, there's something really deep and rich about them and in your connection to them emotionally.
Well, yeah, and I will say that I'm a true Pet Shop Boys fan, so a little bit of me regrets that I named West End Girls, because that's sort of like, you know, it's like,
oh man, you can't pick a favorite child.
Oh, I'm into Blur.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, I like song
I thought
two.
You were going to pick Blur,
don't
by the way.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, don't tell a Blur
do the
fan
obvious
you like
one.
Song two. Like,
my favorite album is Beatles' Greatest Hits. Yeah, you can't do that.
Oh, I love Bob Marley.
Yeah.
Legends?
Yeah.
I can't believe they got so many hits on one album. That's the Greatest Hits, in case those of you who don't know. But yeah, I think this has been full of surprises.
Yeah. By the way, we're not gatekeepers. You are allowed to like Greatest Hits, and you are allowed to wear the band t-shirt to the show. We don't have those kinds of like snobby rules on this show. We're all inclusive.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. I am producer, songwriter, and DJ Luxury.
And I am actor, writer, and sometimes DJ Diallo Riddle, and this is One Song. Until next time.
Until next time.
One Song is a SiriusXM and Kevin Hart's LOL Radio production. It's hosted by me, Luxury, and my friend Diallo Riddle. This episode was produced by Matthew Nelson and Jordan Colling, with engineering from Marcus Hom. Additional production support from Leslie Guam, Charles Childers, and Alicia Shimada. The show is executive produced by Kevin Hart, Ty Randolph, Mike Stein, Brian Smiley, Eric Eddings, and Eric Weil.
Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of 6 live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.